Welcome to the Dive Podcast, presented by Willamette Week, where every Saturday we discuss the biggest news stories of the week with Portland's noisiest newsmakers, savviest culturistas, and some of the best journalists in the game. I'm your host, Brianna Wheeler, and I want to hear from you. So send your questions and comments to me, bwheeler@wweek.com. All right, y'all, enjoy the show.
There are four seasons in Portland. Cold flop, wet rainbow, balls hot, and fall arts. Not to be confused with basic Ugg boot pumpkin spice autumn, fall arts is a complex and diverse season that usually has little or nothing to do with exclusive lattes. Every year, fall arts season brings innovative theater productions, genre-bending film fests, stunning dance and literary projects, and it kicks off time-based art, Portland's iconic citywide interdisciplinary art festival. For creative types and aficionados heading into a long, cold flop season, fall arts can sustain us, inspire us, and keep us creatively engaged for a whole nother year. No disrespect to balls hot art or wet rainbow art or even cold flop season art, but fall arts is arguably the best Portland season. So, like, let's just put on our scarves and get to appreciating. It's Saturday, September 10th, and this is episode 88 of The Dive. On this week's episode of The Dive, I'm celebrating fall arts with two great convos. I'm chatting with Josie Seed, the star of the play Fucking A, a contemporary dystopian interpretation of The Scarlet Letter about an abortionist seeking to buy her son's freedom. I'll also be chatting with contributing WW writer Chance Solemn Pfeiffer about Portland Art Museum's Docorama, a queer AF documentary fest also heralding fall art season. We'll get into both of those chats in just one sec, but first, here's what I learned from this week's edition of Willamette Week. For the longest time, the neighborhood surrounding Horsford Middle School in the southeast has used the school's expansive field to walk their dogs. Now, a new fence and security protocol has curbed those dog walkers, and they are mega pissed. Dog owners have been cutting locks, cutting fences, and running their dogs despite the urging of security guards. They've even been filmed having entitlement meltdowns when asked to leash their dogs. The school won't file harassment or destruction charges, but the court of public opinion does tend to look down upon spoiled dog walkers. Andrew Janowski reports the first hands-on gay strip club in Portland, Fuzzy Navels, is facing challenges in the era of monkeypox. Can you imagine? Their motto is, if it's legal and you can afford it, we can make it happen. So, gosh, I wonder what challenges they could possibly be facing. I tell you, even in the face of a pandemic, men are going to be out here just doing man things. Men going to be men, men going to man. Sophie Peel reports that three downtown hotels are facing foreclosure. The Hilton, Dunaway, and Dossier Hotel's vacant halls are a clear signal that downtown has entered a new stage in its evolution from established city hub to dystopian ghost town. Between all the empty cubicles, offices, and boutique suites, one might see a resolution to Portland's epic housing crisis. How many boutique hotels does one city need, anyway? Now, let's catch up with Josie Seed about her role in the upcoming production of Fucking A.
So tell me a little bit about the play.
Yes, it is. It's a story of a woman who is essentially like the abortionist in this town, this kind of dystopian kind of reality town. And really, she's doing this work to buy her son's freedom, because in this society, that's how you get people out of jail, is you have to pay them. But of course, you know, they move things to be in their favor, and trumped up charges and miscalculations cause her to continue to have to do this work. So,
Yeah, that's not too far removed from what...
It's kind of scary, isn't it, how the parallels that we can see.
Truly, yeah. I was doing a bunch of research on my own family history, And one of my ancestors, like, kind of the story of his life is about buying the freedom of his wife.
So, wow.
Yeah, hearing you describe this part of the play is really, like, this is going to resonate. This is going to resonate with audiences in ways that maybe the original novel didn't or couldn't.
Yeah. And I think the thing about it, because I feel like there's a lot of, like, energy around the fact that, you know, this woman does abortions, which is absolutely completely relevant. But at the same time, you know, it's a story about families that have been separated because of the trappings of an oppressive society, right? And it's about, you know, somebody trying to find their way back home. And it's about, I mean, there's so many elements of it. It's such a huge people-centric piece if you give yourself the space to see all of that. And then once again, as we were talking about the parallels, right, it brings us back to who we are right now in this time, because I feel like we can get so focused on, you know, one thing or, you know, or one act, and we don't say, but who is the person performing that act and why? You know, like, what are their given circumstances that are driving them in that direction? And that's where we're losing our grace and our forgiveness. And I just totally, like, went off.
Yeah, your character is based on one of the most, gosh, I don't know, one of the most important female protagonists in contemporary literature. Tell me about your Hester.
She is, you know, she's pretty single-minded. She is absolutely a mother first. Before she's anything else, she's a mother first. But she has so many facets, right? Like, she's brave. And she can be really vulnerable. And she is strong. And she's got a lot of heart. She's a friend. You know, a good friend. And so she's just this really beautiful, multifaceted people. But, like, if anybody sees the play and doesn't say, she is absolutely fully a mom, then I'm not doing my job.
Well, speaking of, how do you anticipate the audiences reacting, considering the relevance of this play? Are we going to be crying in the aisles? Are we going to be screaming? Are we going to be leaving enraged? Or are we going to be feeling empowered?
Yeah, I mean, I think that goes back to what I was saying about, like, the multifacets of this story. There's so much for people to, like, latch on to. And, you know, being able to see themselves in this play. I think people are going to laugh sometimes. I think that the people will definitely cry, because there's the thing is just riddled with injustice. People are going to be angry. So I think this is one where you're going to get all the feels.
All of the feels. Oh.
Yeah.
We know this is triggering subject matter.
Yeah.
Now, to whom this subject matter is so relevant, are they going to walk away empowered in the same way that the Scarlet Letter empowered generations prior, do you think?
It's absolutely a tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure they're going to walk away feeling empowered.
Okay. Enlightened?
Dum, dum, dum.
Dum, dum, dum. When's the run?
Yeah, October the 6th through November the 5th at Shaking a Tree. You can definitely go to their website, and the information will be probably better than what I'm giving you. There's a little bit of everything in this. Because you're going to get some amazing stories, some beautiful acting. There's music in this play. And we have some incredibly talented actors, performers who are, like, playing their own instruments while we're doing this thing. There is a made-up language called Talk. So we're also, you know, doing some stuff in another language. So there's a little bit of everything in it, yeah.
Thanks, Josie. Now let's unpack Chance Solomon Pfeiffer's coverage of Pam Cutt's Doc-O-Rama.
Yeah, so Doc-O-Rama, as they're calling it, is this kind of cluster of five films that Pam Cutt, which is like the film shingle of the Art Museum, formerly the Northwest Film Center, it's five films that they're putting on at the Witzel Auditorium in the Art Museum in September, starts on September 16th. The theme is, like, a little hard to explicate in like one phrase to put in a headline, but the focus, I think, broadly, you could say, is on queer performance and artists who've devoted their lives in one way or another to social justice.
Mm-hmm. Is this the first of this type of festival for PamCut?
It is, yes. And a very malleable structure that John Richardson, who's their associate director of programming, was telling me could easily be done again anytime they want to take these sorts of ambitious documentaries and draw a theme. They could make great use of that auditorium and do so.
I was wondering, are all of the movies made by fellows of the program?
Just the one, and the one being Workhorse Queen, which kind of ended up being the centerpiece of my story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the director, Angela Washko, was part of their Sustainability Labs program in 2021. And so this was like a good opportunity for them to kind of officially draw that link now that the film's out in the world.
Mm-hmm. How long has the film been released?
It came out, I was doing festivals last year, so 2021. And three of the docs are very new. All Man, the International Mail Story, which is about the Jean Burkhardt who founded the International Mail catalog, and Moon Age Daydream, which is this, could well be a front runner for best documentary at the Oscars. It's the first official, like, authorized David Bowie doc that's allowed to use all of his music. Brett Morgan directed it, and it's very, like, it looks appropriately kaleidoscopic and adventurous. I misspoke slightly. Those two are brand new. Workhorse Queen and then Aggie. Aggie's about this art collector named Agnes Gund, who devoted a lot of her philanthropy to causes like Black Lives Matter. That one came out a couple years ago. And then the one that started it, actually, that I know was the PamCut's director, Amy Dodson. It was her pick. She just really wanted to show it because she found it to be a great, like, subcultural portrait. It was Wildness, which came out about 10 years ago in 2012, and is about the bar Silver Platter, which is a Los Angeles LGBTQ bar with quite a history for the Latino community in LA.
So this is really like a wide range of documentaries. This isn't just like things that came out just through this program.
No. It's pretty much like 10 years of documentaries about adventurous artists. Like I said, it's not like the tightest theme in the world. Not that it has to be. Not that it has to be.
I still love it. I'm particularly stoked about the International Mail documentary. My dad used to have international mail catalogs in the house all of the time. And he came out when I was about 12 years old. And then in adulthood, I went, dang, we really did have international mail catalogs around the house. Everything's coming together.
That's great. I mean, yeah, I think that's in the way they're kind of marketing that doc, which I have not seen it yet. I would really like to. Is just that, yeah, Jean Burkhardt, the founder, was a closeted Midwestern veteran until he came out and founded the magazine. But just how it kind of changed fashion for a lot of men, but specifically like with a lot of an influence in the gay community, but like a real kind of like. Like a wink and a nod,
totally.
In a lot of ways.
It was very much like the JCPenney catalog, but for closeted gay men and out gay men.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you didn't get a chance to see all of the films? Did you get a chance to see any of them?
Just Workhorse Queen, and then no one in Portland, to my knowledge, has seen Moon Age Daydream yet.
Is Moon Age Daydream premiering at Docorama?
I believe the first local screening is actually the week before. I think Cinema 21 has it on the 23rd, and then PamCut has it a week later.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it should be really sweet. And probably a great doc to see in a theater, just like, because you just get so much Bowie footage.
Oh, yeah. And it sounds kaleidoscopic.
The trailer blew my mind, so I can only imagine how good the real thing is.
So they're using like archival footage and yep. All the music and all the official stuff.
Yeah, but it looks like it's, you know, edited together in like an appropriately like Bowie adventurous way.
Oh.
Not like a,
you know, born David Bowie in the year. I don't think it'll be like that. Although that's not his real name either. Sorry, but
it's not going to be like an Errol Morris documentary.
No, I don't think there will be direct to camera interviews. There won't be any Ken Burns slow pans. I think it'll be, you know, out there in a fitting way.
I love that.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that the associate director of creative programs, John Richardson, said that this could be a reoccurring series. Mm-hmm. After kind of spending time investigating it, what do you think filmmakers should do to advocate for that?
The big mission of PamCut that they explicate quite often, and this is kind of part of the rebrand from the Northwest Film Center that occurred last year, is like they just really want to highlight people who are pushing cinema forward and trying stuff and, you know, voices that are outside the mainstream, of course. Something like Docorama, they could just put together because they love the look of, you know, five docs that are all doing different things, all telling untold stories. So, you know, for local artists, people should just keep, you know, making their passion projects and putting things on screen that haven't been on screen before. That's what PamCut is super, super into.
Mm-hmm. What was the most interesting thing that you learned while you were putting this all together?
That's a good question. I think, frankly, maybe the effectiveness of sustainability labs, which is kind of the PamCut's like professional development program that they get five artists and filmmakers into each year. I know the 2022 fellows have been selected but not announced yet. And I think that the approach and the effectiveness of sustainability labs, at least according to Angela Washko, who made Workhorse Queen about Mrs. Kasia Davis, because it's not the kind of thing where you go in and you're like, I want to make this documentary about Mrs. Kasia Davis. Like, how do I set up a camera? It's much more like they want an artist who may be in like the middle of their career, who may not quite know like how to get to that next step.
Mm-hmm.
And then like the roster of people that they'll bring in to do a panel with them will be tailored to whatever that filmmaker like wants to work on and wants to talk about, which is really rad too.
Wow.
They're a really cool ability to like meet the filmmakers like where they're at. Mm-hmm. Like Angela Washko has an interesting story. She's like a super well-recognized artist in the fine arts space. She's an associate professor at Carnegie Mellon. She's done all kinds of like museum installations and things, but she'd never made a documentary before. So they were just able to help her with something like as elemental as like how to pitch, how to talk to people about like your documentary in the way that movie people talk. And it was really cool to hear how much that helped her and took someone who, in her case, she'd never made a documentary before, and I assume she very well could have gone back to working on museum pieces if she wanted. She still might, but instead, like with some of that advice, now like has a producing partner and another doc series kind of about to go into production. It changed like the course of her career, which I just think is so cool because, you know, a professional development thing for filmmakers, that could mean anything.
Sure.
So it was really cool to hear how effective it was for her.
Yeah, that is awesome how it's dialed in for each of the all the participants. Yeah. That's wild.
That takes a lot of organizational work. It was cool to hear.
Yeah, truly to like unlock all of those different facets of an industry. How do you deal with distribution? How do you deal with pitching? Because a lot of that stuff is so like secret knowledge held so close.
Totally. Yeah, and is not always like shared because of weird, you know, competition
gatekeepers.
So it's great. Exactly. It was great that they were able to lay that bare for her.
Was there anything left out of the piece?
Probably just like some more musings on, because Angela sort of loved to talk about the background of Workhorse Queen, and I wish there would have been more room to just talk about kind of Ed Popple, aka Mrs. Kasia Davis, like his story.
Mm-hmm.
Because really, it's really interesting, and it's, of course, central to the doc. Finding drag later in life, not quite fitting into any, like, a standard mold of any, like, RuPaul's Drag Race contestant.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of making that Mrs. Kasia Davis persona of like the self-proclaimed like international housewife, internationally famous housewife or whatever it is. You know, that actually means a lot to Ed's story and how it's modeled after his mother and the what it means to sort of like a reconciliation with his father and just how he lives his life in this booming community of drag in Rochester. So for all that stuff, people can go see Workhorse Queen at the Witzel on September 16th. And if you can't pull that off, it is on VOD all over the internet.
Big thanks to my guests this week, Josie Seed and Chance Solomon Pfeiffer. And big thanks to you, too. Thank you for joining me. I hope to see you again next week. And hey, go enjoy some fall arts. Bye!